Hello, and welcome to Season 8 of the Canadian Women's Foundation podcast, All Right, Now What? Gender equality and justice, where we live, work, learn, and play, is the goal, and it makes life better for everyone. All Right, Now What? Remains a space where we ask, how do we move from awareness to action? But this season, we're also shifting the story. Through powerful storytelling, expert interviews, and bold conversations, we'll explore what true equity can look like, especially for those who are too often silenced or overlooked. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and its partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Inuit, and Métis territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations.
Hi, I'm Rachel Leslie from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Today we're joined by Salam Debs, an anti-racism educator, anti-oppression coach, and one of four winners of the 2026 Feminist Creator Prize. In our conversation, Salam reflects on her journey growing up as a Black Ethiopian woman in Canada, and how her lived experiences have shaped her work at the intersections of race, gender, and identity. She shares how her understanding of intersectionality is deeply rooted in both personal history and the broader legacy of Black feminist thought. We talk about what's behind growing backlash against DEI and how Salam stays grounded in the face of it, drawing on culture, community, and practices of rest, healing, and resistance. She also speaks about the power of digital spaces to tell the truth and support collective learning. And finally, we explore what it really means to move from awareness to action and why understanding history is a critical place to begin. Welcome, Salam. I'm very excited to chat with you today. I'd love for you to talk about your work and the journey. We know your work sits really at the intersection of race and gender and queerness. But what was the journey that brought you where you are today? And why is intersectionality essential in your work?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. And I think that question regarding intersectionality in my journey, I always think about, you know, first I always think about my mother's journey and my family's journey. I think about how my mom at a very young age, you know, left Ethiopia. And a very common experience is, you know, walking by foot to Sudan, from Sudan, living there for many years, and then eventually moving to Jordan, having me, and then my mother and father coming to Canada in the 1980s and growing up in Scarborough and in Regent Park area in Toronto. And growing up in, you know, very disinvested communities. So communities that were extremely rich in terms of culture. I'm very fortunate to have grown up in such culturally rich spaces and communities. And communities that were, you know, heavily surveilled, disinvested in. And when I think about and I look at my mother's journey and how she was, you know, having to navigate Canada and navigate Toronto as a Black Ethiopian African woman, I can see the correlations and the connections between her experience and then my experience coming here at a young age, and how I was so fortunate enough to see images of Black girls and Black women and Black femmes that were my archetype for, you know, hair. You know, we kind of grew up in a very, we grew up in a kind of special time in the 80s and 90s, if folks can remember, for anyone that grew up in that time. We were really fortunate enough to see imagery that that we could look up to, that we could see and feel proud of. You know, when I think about my Ethiopian culture and the aunties and, you know, how our communities were very matriarchal, you know, and I think about how I grew up seeing images, you know, through R&B and hip hop and reggae and soca and rap music and dance music, and how we were so lucky to see people that look like us. And I saw people that look like me that was you know, my representation for what was possible. And that imagery of, you know, empowerment, of, you know, telling it how it is, of really speaking truth to power, of really loving yourself, loving your body, of embodying who you really are. So I think about that aspect. And then I also think about the connection between when things started to shift and, you know, we couldn't really avoid the messaging also that was in place, Rachel, which was the messaging was, you know, you needed to be in proximity to white womanhood and you needed to kind of be more of that in order for you to excel, succeed. You needed to code switch. So there's this kind of polarity in how I grew up. And I think a lot of, you know, Black women and femmes can really relate to how we grew up. If you grew up in the 80s and 90s, really feeling empowered. And at the same time, this kind of decline and shift and transformation in that, and where you had to really assimilate and really had to code switch for survival. And so intersectionality really, when we think about it, I always think about Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, who was the founder of intersectionality. She coined the term in 1989 to talk about the intersection between gender, race, sexual orientation, and how that experience is overlapping. And so there really isn't any way to understand my life and my journey as a mother, as a, you know, teacher, I used to be a yoga studio owner, as an advocate, without understanding how my experience of being a Black woman, you know, being Ethiopian, all of the different dynamics, sexual orientation, really playing a role in how you see yourself, and how you see, you feel affirmed in your culture, and then how you feel a lack of affirmation when you have to move outside of your culture.
Thank you. And I'm thinking, you know, we were looking back right there and talking about your journey and, you know, bringing you to the space you are working in today. And then really looking and thinking about, you know, the backlash that's happening around DEI initiatives across North America, especially over the last year and a half. From your perspective, what's really happening right now?
Well, I mean, you know, when we think about DEI is a term that people are aware of now, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion. But if we really look back in history, if we think about the civil rights movement, you know, throughout North America, throughout the world, but in particular, if we think about the Black American and, you know, Black Canadian perspective, that there has always been backlash to the, you know, the fight towards freedom, the fight towards equity, and the struggle towards that. So we know that there is a record of that. We know that there's a record of that pushback, and, you know, and that backlash. I think now what we're seeing is a kind of particular type, because now, you know, it has a new name. There's a new conversation around it. And a big part of, you know, what happened in the, you know, 60s and 70s and 80s and even so the 90s and 2000s, there was a lot of work around, you know, ensuring that people were hired equitably, that there was, you know, policies and legislation in place to prevent discrimination and so forth. And now what we're seeing is this kind of desire or wanting to, you know, pull all of that legislation, those policies away. And, you know, really at the end of the day, whether it's a civil rights movement, whether it's DEI, whether it's anti-racism policies, these are all human rights policies. And we know that there is a kind of narrative that has been bubbling up for a while now, right here in Canada and throughout North America, which is this idea of, for example, the DEI hire. You know that Black and brown, racialized, queer folks, folks with disabilities are only getting jobs or getting opportunities because of, you know, basically as a token, and that they're not qualified, that we're not, you know, qualified for these roles or for these opportunities. And that kind of just plays into a longstanding perspective, which is that of meritocracy, you know, that people who have hold positions of power, if we think about white cisgender men, have held these positions of power because of merit, because of being qualified. And yes, sometimes, you know, people are qualified, and we know that folks, you know, get into the positions that they're in because of advantage. And so I think what we're seeing is there's all these myths and misconceptions, right? That Black, and especially this idea of Black and brown and racialized people getting roles or opportunities because of their race, rather than this idea that Black and brown and racialized people and women are often very overqualified. We often have to work twice, if not three times as hard. And when we do, you know, get into these positions, we're often have to be very hypervigilant. You know, we're often, you know, highly criticized and so forth, and zoomed in on. So I think, you know, really what's happening is there is a kind of like last standing for maintaining a certain predatory power that we see has been how our systems have operated. And actually, when you uncover, Rachel, when you uncover DEI, the people who actually benefit the most from DEI is white women. And statistics and data, you know, prove that in terms of legislation and policies and practices. And so the reality is what needs to happen, and I know we're going to talk about that later, but what really needs to happen is demystifying and really naming these like lacks of truth, these lies around what DEI really is. You know, there's conversations around people being too woke. Woke was a term that was developed, you know, by the Black community, Black American community, and now has been co-opted and has been stolen and demonized and so forth. So, you know, we need to move away from this idea of charity and realize that actually what we're doing is righting wrongs and giving back what's owed to communities that have been denied access. But yeah, it's just a lot of crying and yelling about wanting to maintain systems. And I guess what I would say really quick is, you know, equity feels like oppression to those who benefit from oppression. So if you want to maintain systems that you benefit from, well, of course, you're going to attempt to take away, you know, the progression in place that is giving back what's owed to Black and brown, racialized, you know, women, femmes, queer, folks with disabilities. And the reality is, actually, when we're in those spaces, the spaces are more creative, they're more uplifted, greater ideas, they're less homogenous. And, you know, oftentimes there is a kind of desire to prevent that because it takes away the idea of merit. And really starts to recognize, you know, the brilliance and the beauty and the diversity that we bring into those spaces.
So I guess my other question to you is, as you said, you know, it's hard work and it's, you know, challenging. But when you're fatigued or discouraged or, you know, seeing this backlash come under another name, what helps you stay grounded and kind of committed to the work that you're doing?
I mean, I always make the joke that, you know, I'm not going to, like, I'm going to lay down. I'm going to take my rest when I need to. You know, these ideas of Audre Lorde, which is rest is resistance. You know, it's not self-indulgence to care for myself, to paraphrase. And I think we're really fortunate. Well, let me just back up for a second. So really the reality is when we think about systems of oppression, they're oppressing all of us. So we think about the Western world or a colonial society, you know, countries like Canada and the US and parts of Europe and, you know, Australia, New Zealand, all of these parts of the world that we consider the Western world. So typically countries, lands, spaces that have benefited from colonialism, benefited, you know, from extracting resources, people, off of the backs of Black and brown and racialized people. That the exchange for that, the exchange for, you know, building power and wealth and developing, you know, these societies that are considered progressive, We even call them first world countries or developed countries, which is language that we really need to change, because these are countries that have benefited from colonialism and enslavement and predatory, you know, domination and so forth. What happens when you live in a society that is built off of that is that it focuses on product over people, and that we're all suffering under these systems where we're all tired. We all have low grade, high grade anxiety. You know, we're all overworked. We're all suffering from perfectionism. You know, we're all, essentially, we're all suffering from a white colonial society and the characteristics that come with it. And so I think what I'm really grateful for is that I grew up in another culture, which is my Ethiopian, you know, Black diasporan culture, that taught me about rest, that taught me about joy, that is rooted in, you know, movement and dance and ways in which, you know, somatic healing practices, and, you know, where our lands and our countries and our people, you know, unfortunately in a racist society, names our cultures, you know, lazy or unproductive, or that we're, you know, not as progressive, for example, as the so-called developed world or Western world. But the reality is we embody things where community is essential, where, for example, in Ethiopian culture, we eat with our hands and we feed each other what we call gorsha. It's a sign of love. We eat on one big plate as, you know, a couple of us as friends or family. We gather in ways where we are supporting and caring for each other. So I think for me, I tap into that. I tap into my culture, whether it's tapping into, you know, our siblings in terms of Black American culture that definitely raised me, you know, Black Caribbean culture, Black African, specifically Ethiopian culture, and how that has raised me, that it's my bomb. You know, it provides my nervous system ease. So I can take off that hat and I can recognize that it is an act of liberation and resistance when I rest. It's not lazy. It's not unproductive. And I think having that embedded in me, in my culture, and also grateful enough to read books like, you know, Hood Feminism by Mickey Kendall or Rest is Resistance by Trisha Hershey, that those continuously reaffirm the knowing that I know on an ancestral level, that, you know, my body and my well-being and that me just being is enough. You know, it's not my job to eradicate these systems of oppression. In fact, I always share with Black and brown and racialized women and femmes that it is really our job to find ways that where we can thrive. So yeah, that's a little bit of what I do.
Yeah, and the when you're speaking, the two words that came to mind were like community and also care, that you're really connecting with others, but also caring for yourself. And as you said, we're almost trained not to do that or to feel guilt about it, or if we're not producing, we're not worth something, right? So just to be able to stand up against that is an act of resistance, as you said. Super happy to say congratulations. You're one of this year's recipients of the Canadian Women's Foundation, the Feminist Creator Prize. What does this recognition mean to you personally and professionally?
You know, I will say that, to be very honest, as I am, anyone that knows me knows I'm very direct. You know, for a long time, I would have probably felt misaligned with the idea of, you know, being named like a feminist, only because I find that historically, when we look at feminist movements, like, you know, we know that Black and brown and racialized women and femmes have been, you know, minimized and pushed out of these spaces. And we think historically around the suffrage movement and who was allowed, you know, to even vote in those times, who was being advocated and seen as fully human and who wasn't. I always think about Sojourner Truth, where she said, "Ain't I a woman?" You know, which was a speech where she spoke on the idea that Black women at one time, due to enslavement, due to colonialism, we're not really considered full human beings, 3/5 human, but also we're not recognized in the same way that, you know, white women and femmes are recognized in society, and in terms of social determinants. And so I think about if I asked my mom, like, mom, do you see yourself as a feminist? She'd be like, what are you talking about? But the reality is, when you actually look historically, when you do the work and you start to study from the Audre Lordes and you begin to study with, you know, the Alice Walkers and Toni Morrison, Kimberly Crenshaw, you know, Mickey Kendall, all of these voices, Maya Angelou's, all of these voices that were really critical in the conversations around Black feminism, Black feminist movements, that I was able to identify and see myself finally. And so I feel proud to be able to say that today I am a Black feminist, because of the Black women who came before me and showed us and showed me what it means to be fully embodied, that you don't have to actually escape yourself or leave yourself or code switch from who you are to be a feminist, that you can be an abolitionist and also be a Black woman who is fighting for gender rights. And part of fighting for gender rights that I learned over time was recognizing that my son, as a Black boy who's 20 years old now, so, you know, basically a Black young man, that he was part of that conversation because of the history of how he has not been considered, you know, safe in the world and seen as an inherent threat in the world. And so part of my ideas around Black feminism includes my son. And so with all of that knowing and all of that knowledge and wisdom that came before me, I'm able to like claim a prize like this and be like, yes, I deserve to be here. It feels aligned. I feel like we can begin to apply, like we talked about earlier, an intersectional feminist lens to how we understand gender equity. And I'm grateful. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm really looking forward to what's to come and the conversations to have. But yeah, I'm really deeply grateful because I feel like I can do it in an embodied way today as I've done that kind of unlearning, relearning, and reclamation process as a Black woman.
You've built a digital platform of over 34,000 people and supported over 8,000 individuals through your anti-racism course. What shifts online have you witnessed that give you some hope?
Yeah, we're really fortunate to have the online space. I think especially in Canada, you know, if folks aren't aware that even Canada doesn't really have its platforms online anymore, its media platforms. And let's be honest, in Canada, there is a kind of PR that prevents really, you know, honest conversations oftentimes. You know, Canada's known for its like niceness. And so oftentimes we don't see a lot of the stories that should be really front and center and named. And so I think social media has become this space where we can tell the truth, where we can connect throughout this global community and get the truth from the source, or begin to, like we saw in 2020 in terms of our phones and being able to record and get that truth out, truth that would typically be, you know, basically suppressed. The only thing that changes our phones. And so I'm grateful that of building that community of folks that are like-minded, that are really committed to this work or invested in wanting to do this unlearning and relearning. So I think the shift has really been that we have a space now where we can, for the most part, be, you know, unapologetically honest about what's happening in the world and connect in real ways. So I think there's a growing community of that sort. And the truth is, you know, online is not always easy as well, because it does mean that there's a lot of targeting that happens as well. So I think it's a kind of balance between the two. But fortunately, people that we would never have been able to learn from or know about, we know about now in real ways. And so I'm definitely grateful for that.
All right, now what? So for the listeners who are ready to move from awareness to action, what's one place you would tell them to begin?
I think my recommendation would be, since we are talking about gender equity, about women and femmes and non-binary folks, is to take the time to study the history. It's really key in order for us to really support. You know, we use language like intersectionality, and we use language like, you know, feminist, and we often don't know the history behind it. You know, when you're using the term intersectionality, have you looked into and read about or taken time to tap into Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, who is the founder and coined this term intersectionality? Have we learned about the fact that the reason why she coined it was because there was this case that she was working on as a lawyer, where a workplace environment, you know, basically an employer, they were hiring, you know, white women and they were hiring black men. And their perspective was, well, this is equitable. You know, we are hiring equitably. And they showed the gap, and she showed the gap around that black women weren't getting hired. And when she presented this case, the argument back was, well, we're hiring men, or my apologies, we're hiring black people and we're hiring women. So there was this, and they believed that there was a kind of advantage that black women would receive by being recognized as both woman and being black, which is wild to think about when you really look at it. And so it is essential for us to dive into and look into these things, understand the suffrage movement. And as amazing as it is to celebrate women's and femmes' history in terms of the progress, you know, it is important for us to understand what was happening at that time, that, you know, black and brown women were going into, while white women were fighting, for example, for, you know, equity in terms of jobs and being able to work outside of the home and so forth, black and brown women were going into the homes and caring for the children. Or, you know, are we learning about how black and brown and racialized women have often been erased from parts of these conversations? That there's often a perspective around like all women and femmes. And we want to bring almost like a race neutral idea, but there's no such thing. That in the conversation of womanhood, of femmes, of non-binary folks, that there is a conversation of race. And in order for us to be truly equitable, in order for us to be truly inclusive, like we like to use that term, then it is essential that we get very specific and uncover the experiences of Black women, Indigenous women, you know, racialized women, queer women, you know, Black, brown, racialized, Indigenous women who have disabilities, who are neurodivergent, who are queer, and so forth, that the intersection of that can't be erased. And oftentimes there's a tendency to erase, pun intended, the racial part of it, race. And when we do that, as Rachel Cargill says, to paraphrase, you know, if you're speaking on feminism without an anti-racist lens, then it's simply just white supremacy in heels. And it's essential for us to bring that sense of that lens, that critical thinking lens, so that we ensure that we are looking at and examining and interrogating how racism, how bias shows up, how advantage and disadvantage shows up in the gender equity movement, and then what it looks like for us to show up and do better.
Thank you for helping shift the story on safety, leadership, justice, power, and rights. You can visit CanadianWomen.org today to learn more and stay connected. We believe everyone should be able to exist without fear of harassment or abuse. You can help make that a reality. Text SAFE, S-A-F-E, to 20222 to give $10 and support women, girls, and gender diverse people throughout Canada. Small actions can lead to big changes. We appreciate your support.